at episode 565 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and yeah, I guess that's the reaction I should have expected when I tore that wig off.
And so when we put all of this together, does this comprise the Critical Myth cinematic universe? I guess not. Anyway, we are going to be going over, like I said, all of these various shows that were on this past weekend. As I mentioned at the end of last episode, 26 episodes. And this time, it wasn't even that we had like a double episode premiere. No.
No.
26 episodes, 26 shows, big week. Spreading anywhere from traditional networks to all kinds of cable networks to premium channels to Netflix. And even a little PlayStation Network. So all over the map here. But yeah, we started off a little bit with the bottom three shows of the week in our Monday show. But we're going to go ahead and lead this one off with the top three of the week. And I'm happy to report that these were definitely much, much, much better.
Yes, much indeed. Better.
Edmund, before we get into any of that, I think you have to give a disclaimer. A little bit, you know,
yes,
late for those bottom shows, but nobody really... was worried about that, right?
Not really. But these ones you should be. We, as ever, will discuss whatever we like about these episodes. So, yes, you will most likely be spoiled if you haven't caught up yet. But, heck, it was last week. You really should have watched these by now. Really, honest.
Yeah, no kidding. Not the least of which would have been these top shows. I mean, really, these are the shows that everybody should have been watching. Right? Especially this one. Edmund, why don't you go ahead and get us started off with... Our number three show for the week.
Number three show is Person of Interest, Season 4, Episode 21, Asylum. Reese and Fusco are caught in the war between crime lords Elias and Dominic. A clue to Shaw's whereabouts leads Finch and Root into a possible trap, and Control goes rogue to learn the truth about the Samaritan program.
Yes, and boy, does this get... start bringing all of these various shows, or rather... plot threads from over the season and bring them into focus and lead us right into that that finale next time. This one came in at an average of 8.67, and I have to say I'm actually impressed that it came in as high as it did, considering that there are elements of this season that just haven't been the strongest.
Mm-hmm.
And they were in this episode. I'm looking at you, Brotherhood.
Yes. But we had Elias around, so that it didn't matter as much.
I suppose not. But what can you add to this, Edmund?
Yeah, I mean, I guess for me, it was the fact that I thought they did a very good job for an episode that was very much a setup for the finale. But certainly, I mean, after after having had all of these separate elements of the Samaritan forces and their sort of private army and the New York crime stuff. I mean, having it all come together in one location, and certainly the last thing I was expecting was the fact that they're going to be walking into one of the Samaritan control rooms when they were hitting the asylum. So yeah, the way they were laying everything out, but in a way that was also upping the ante and the tension levels, and just when you think you've got a handle on what they're doing, giving it that extra little push was very nicely done.
Yeah, definitely. And this is one of those situations where, quite frankly, I don't know who's going to get out of this unscathed, if anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I thought, a pretty interesting direction for them to go, because we've already had a fairly major loss, maybe not technically. I mean, they pretty much reveal here that, no, in fact, Shaw is alive.
Yes.
In some capacity. Not that we were all that surprised about that. But what capacity? Mm-hmm. You know, she's clearly not coming back anytime soon. But... is everyone going to be, if she's not gone, they've still established that people can and will be victims of all this stuff. And it may even be the machine to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
Although I do feel like there's got to be some kind of thing in the machine's back pocket, some gambit that's going to come into play here, because it would be quite upsetting if this was the end of their line. And well, considering that the show is not ending, I'm fairly sure the machine is not going to be destroyed. So something's going to happen here, but I'm at a loss as to what exactly that might be. And that's what I like about this particular episode as a penultimate episode, is that it's not obvious how this is going to get resolved. The sense of danger is palpable here.
Yeah, and actually, I was just thinking about that in terms of the way they keep sort of basically increasing the complexity and tension in these season finales. You know, and to the point where with last season's you certainly knew the confrontation it was building towards, but certainly did not expect that ending with all of them on the run. And then with this one, where it they managed to build up the AI war bring it to this head, but especially after that curveball they threw at the end of last season, it really is quite amazing that they've set up this situation where, yes, you can see the different possibilities, but you really have no idea which one it's actually going to go.
Exactly. Now, any other pieces of this that you felt were noteworthy?
Trying to think, but I believe Bronze Thumb might have had something to say.
Yeah, we do have some comments from Bronze Thumb on this one. And it is something that I was kind of waiting to see if you had anything else to say first.
Yes.
The one of the things that came to my mind towards the end of this episode was that I remember joking with Bronze Thumb on Facebook and a few other people that I think that Team Machine might want to have a few words with Director Fury about this whole Operation Insight thing that he's rolling out, because it's not going to end very well. I did think that it was a little bit unusual that Person of Interest had its tie-in with Winter Soldier a year after it came out, and it was on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. But obviously we're joking around about the fact that what Samaritan is doing is pretty much exactly what the Gambit was for Hydra in Winter Soldier, which is identify anyone who could be a threat to the system and kill them off all at once. Which is an odd thing from my perspective, because Person of Interest has been so good at anticipating how things could evolve before anybody else seems to think about it or it happens in reality, that it's like, wow, wait, they feel behind the curve here a little bit. It didn't really hold us back from giving it a high score, obviously, but yeah. And I'm not saying it's bad. Neither was Bronstein when he was getting around about that, because if anything, there were implications to that of course could not be explored in a 2-hour film that we're probably going to see play out on mm-hmm. Person of Interest, and that's an awesome thing.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, so, 8.67, if I want to say, with one episode left, to go back to our horse race to see who's going to be in the top five. At this point, Person of Interest has pulled ahead of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. has a few more episodes left than Person of Interest does, but it's going to be a real challenge for Person of Interest to get lapped here.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, they could wind up tying Better Call Saul for the third place spot here.
Wow.
But right now, it's Daredevil's game to lose, at least in terms of fighting for second place.
Yes. Because that's what Daredevil always makes us think of, fighting.
That's right. let's see. Why don't we go ahead with the next one here?
Certainly. And that would be Arrow, Season 3, Episode 20, The Fallen. Ra's al Ghul makes Oliver an offer he can't refuse. The team join Oliver on his journey to Nander Parbat, where a heartbroken Felicity decides to take matters into her own hands.
Mm-hmm. And this one came in at an 8.75. It was only, oddly enough, Nadim and Henry didn't like this nearly as much as the rest of us did. But let's go ahead through some of these comments. From Bronze Thumb, he says, lacking big surprises, but heavy on character beats and dramatic moments. And Gary said that he liked the fact it seemed that Oliver chose to walk the path that Ra's al Ghul was forcing him toward, rather than just being led down that path.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly he enjoyed some of the Oliver-Felicity dialogue. And he actually liked Malcolm Merlyn. So there you go. And I just think it's interesting that he's now an assassin. Welcome to the Brotherhood, Oliver.
Yes. It's official.
It's official now, right? what were your thoughts on this, Edmund?
Yeah, well, certainly it's been interesting for me, because even, you know, as the person who's sort of perhaps most outside the DC universe, to the point where, I mean, I know Ra's al Ghul mainly from the Batman, the more recent Christopher Nolan Batman movies. So I haven't necessarily been burdened with this whole, you know, oh no, this is Ra's is a Batman villain, and this whole storyline is something Batman did. The one sense I have had, though, is that it had been feeling a little bit shoehorned in, especially the effect it was having on Oliver, of just the moping around and sort of snapping at everybody. But with these more recent episodes, as they're getting towards the finale, and having to decide and take action, etc., it has definitely improved the storyline for me considerably.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say, even as we enjoy this episode, and it's our number two slot this week, and Arrow has been fairly consistently towards the top, that this hasn't been the best designed, shall we say, season by any means. It's definitely a weaker season, but I think that in some cases that's because you're going from a villain that was very active and physical in Slade,
yeah,
and you're dealing with Ra's al Ghul, that is, it's more of a philosophical villain. He can be active, however he works best by acting through others, and I think that that's a subtle shift that a lot of people have had a little bit of difficulty with. Plus, the flashbacks, still, we're getting towards the end of the season, and I still don't know that the flashbacks have really been nearly as strong this season. So, yeah, we'll see how it all pans out towards the end and if it all comes together. But I know that for me, that was one of the reasons that I really liked this episode, is that we finally have consequences spilling out for Oliver. But at any rate, that brings us to our number one show for the week. And Edmund, I know you really want to be the one to do this one.
Absolutely. This is The Americans, Season 3, Episode 13, March 8th, 1983. And for those who don't remember what they were doing on that date, in the Season 3 finale, Stan's plan to save Nina has unpredictable consequences. Elizabeth and Paige go on a trip, and Philip finds an unlikely ally after an emotionally charged mission.
Yes, and this one came in at an average of 9.
Yes.
And Edmund, why don't you go ahead and school us a little bit on this one?
Yeah, most fascinating for me was the way that this whole trip to West Berlin panned out, because certainly as they had been building towards this, and it seeming so impossible, or at least certainly impossible to do with official sanction, the way the information got doled out about the fact that yes, okay, Elizabeth and Paige are there, but basically because Philip just stuck him on a plane and said, here, I'm going to fling you as close to the border as I can, and we're going to see what happens. So certainly having that sort of independence to actually go against the center, and basically just put them out there to the point where they had to respond. And even operationally, in a way, I was rather impressed with, you know, with okay, I mean, you know, a travel agent could... It's plausible to go to West Berlin, how they were going to pull off them actually crossing the border and going behind the Iron Curtain, I wasn't quite sure of, and this actually did resolve that. So I thought that whole sequence worked rather well. I mean, as a very emotional sort of reunion and homecoming, but at the same time also still laying the groundwork for the cliffhanger betrayal, or possible betrayal, or whichever way that's going to play out at the very end, where Paige did have this genuinely emotional moment with her grandmother, but then as the praying incident right afterwards revealed, there's still that gulf between them that we will have to wait till next season to find out about.
Yes, indeed. But wow, that was probably the thing that blew me away the most, was that that ending. I was probably among the ones that felt like Paige was going to, reluctantly perhaps, but after meeting with her grandmother and doing this whole trip with her mother, finally kind of get on board.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that she turned around and, I can't imagine how this is going to end well for her. I can't imagine that people aren't. What was surprising me there was that I know it was done for certain stylistic effect, but how is it that they weren't listening in somehow?
Yes, I know.
If not her parents, then someone had to be. And that's the thing that's going to, like, if it's still kind of like an up in the air thing where she's hiding the fact that she's kind of, you know,
yeah,
informing on her parents, that's going to be hard for me to buy.
Yeah, and there's one thing that I know that's one comment that I've seen people have. At other points in the show as well. I mean, people have said, you know, well, you know, wouldn't the center be bugging the house or bugging the phone lines? But people forget. I mean, how actual physically and hardware intensive that process was back then. I mean, you were literally tapping lines and having to have a station that was manned, with people operating tape recorders. And for your directorate S agency, you need to keep as on the down low as possible. You can't have that sort of thing set up, obviously monitoring their house. But I know for me, certainly that was the core of the episode. But the part that I found kind of befuddling and a little annoying was having the whole wind up of the whole Est subplot that's been going on in the background being Philip possibly open up to Sandra Beeman. Not so much that she has been such a sort of peripheral character, and the finale was basically so propulsive that I didn't notice it as much, but until it was over. But it was more when I realized, like, wait a minute, why are we having all this Sandra Beeman stuff when we are not getting the follow up to Martha's reaction to him pulling the wig off? Instead, it's just by inference in terms of them what worrying about how Martha's going to react to the fact that yes, he just covered up her complicity with a staged suicide. the way the whole Clark and Martha dynamic had been going over these last few episodes. I mean, I just really felt it should have gotten a little bit more of a focus in the finale. And you know, that's what kept me at a 9 basically, instead of anything higher.
Yeah, I completely agree. Because I felt like the way they resolved that after such a buildup was anticlimactic. To say, that's probably the easiest way to put it. And I still don't understand exactly what all that S thing is supposed to mean at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, it's a 90-minute finale roughly, and because it was extended.
Yes.
And I'm still trying to figure out why so much time was spent on Sandra.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like, you know, how on Mad Men, they still haven't shown us why we have to keep paying attention to Sally and Betty.
Mm-hmm.
They just, you know, the divorce happened. Let it go. We're allowed to not follow characters anymore. So unless Stan or Sandra and Philip are somehow going to get in some kind of very weird personal relationship, which I don't see happening, or they're really going to start off the fourth season in a bad place.
Yes.
They need to let her go.
Yeah, absolutely. Because certainly, and when the whole S storyline got introduced, I thought, it obviously made complete sense for the times. But just for my childhood memories of how it worked out for the generation before mine, who were making the most use of it, I really expected it just to be this little slightly humorous subplot surrounding the divorce. And once Dan realized that no, he really couldn't accept any of this, they were just going to move on to other things. I never expected it to come back around to, you know, oh no, being the thing that helps Philip deal with his guilt about being an agent. So yeah, I will, you know, hope that my personal disdain for the process and some of the people who went through it will not color what they're trying for next season.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what we're going to do from here, obviously, other than miss the Americans quite a bit, because I think there could have been a case for there being one more episode, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just one more?
Always. Oh, please. Yes.
Okay.
Please.
We're going to move on then to the rest of the episodes that were not at the top, not at the bottom, but were in the middle. And some of these episodes are ones that really could have easily been in our top three if it wasn't for just a couple scores here and there being a little lower than for the others. It was a bit of a race, especially for that number three position. And first on the list here is a pretty big episode, really. And that's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Season 2, Episode 19, The Dirty Half Dozen. Agent Coulson and Gonzalez look past their mutual animosity and join forces in order to defeat Hydra. That's right. Hydra's still around. Yeah. This one came in at an 8.6. So, yes, 0.07 of a point below Person of Interest. This one might actually have suffered from having more people giving scores than Person of Interest. Because as far as myself, Edmund, and Brunston were concerned, we all gave it the same score.
Yeah, it has exactly the same scores. It just has a few too many of them.
Yes, exactly. Gary and Henry came in at 8.5, which was the difference. Now, Brunston says about this one, the best episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. yet, only let down by a disappointing tie-in to Age of Ultron. There must be something in the water at St. Agnes. I'm trying to remember what that's a reference to. We'll get to it, though. Gary said, I love the reveal at the end that Coulson is playing a much larger, longer game than initially shown. That would be the disappointing tie-in, Gary. Anyway, yes. Thought you can have it until Fury asks for it back, meaning the Fury's black box.
Yep.
That exchange was great. I agree. That was pretty funny. And Skye's attacking scene was awesome and loved all the digs on Grant. Let me just start with, first of all, it's hilarious to me that Coulson finally kind of gives in to Gonzalez just when it's revealed that Fury is still alive and oh, we're fighting over who's going to be in charge. Well, some other people might have a say in that.
Yes.
Just pointing that out. I happen to think, as far as Brunstum's comment about the disappointing tie-in, that the direct tie-in was disappointing. However, the fact that everything since the Winter Soldier is effectively a tie-in and lead-in to Age of Ultron, at least a facet of Age of Ultron, is something that shouldn't be ignored in this. And it's something that I really thought was a great thing for the Marvel Cinematic Universe as a whole, that did you need that lead-in? No, but it definitely added shades to things that weren't there otherwise, and it just makes it feel a lot bigger and better as a result. And I'm being very vague because I'm almost sure, Edmund, you didn't see it yet.
No, I haven't.
Oh, you're really the only... You want to know why we're not talking about Age of Ultron, people? Because I think Edmund's the only one out of all of us who hasn't seen it yet.
It's all my fault, really, honest. It's not the fact that half of us aren't here, really.
Really? Yeah, exactly.
If I'd seen it, they would have made time in their busy days. So, yes, it's all my fault.
All right, Agent Ward. I'll be fair, because quite technically, I had to be very quiet about when I saw the film, because I saw it even earlier than Brunstum did.
Wow.
Yes. Haha. And if he's listening, which he's probably scandalized now. Yes. Yes. Sometimes I can, in fact, keep something below my hat.
Yes. Very nicely
Anyhow,
done.
That all being aside, that scene with Skye. Oh, my goodness. That was... Okay, Edmund, you said last episode you haven't seen Kingsman?
Mm-hmm.
This felt like there's a certain cinematic style that some of the big fight scenes have in Kingsman,
mm-hmm.
and it was perfectly replicated in that scene with Skye.
Right.
This one take, multiple... You know, Daredevil's done some of this, too. This one take, multiple points of view, camera constantly shifting to be in the perfect spot to show exactly how the action's panning out, the stop-start type of, you know... cinematic flair. It just this was by far the best fight scene on the whole series, in my opinion.
Oh, absolutely.
And who did it? Skye. Take that, haters.
Yes.
Yeah, so that all being said, Edmund, what are you going to add to what Brunstum, Gary, and I all had to say about this so far?
Well, honestly, you guys have it just about covered. Yeah, I mean, this is with a bunch of the shows that we've been talking about this episode and last. I mean, we're in one of those. It feels like one of those good TV seasons where things are ramping towards their finales, and they're doing it in ways that make us feel confident, which is always a good thing.
Yes, I'm really looking forward to how this season ends, especially when some of this stuff is obviously setting up Age of Ultron.
Yes.
There's going to be some fallout from that film, as one would expect, mm-hmm. that would involve S.H.I.E.L.D. But there's so much in the season that still needs to be resolved in three episodes. So, yeah, there's a lot that these final three episodes are going to have to incorporate. And that's the thing that I'm really interested in seeing, is how well they pull it off. Because I think at this point, we can all be fairly certain that the show's not being canceled. If anything, it's being expanded upon, as we've heard before.
Yeah.
It's got to set up Mockingbird and Hunter moving into their own series. So, yeah. What's that going to mean? That's the thing that I think is the most interesting. How is this all going to pan out in three episodes? It's not a whole lot of time. But anyway, Edmund, why don't you take the next one?
Certainly. That would be Daredevil, Season 1, Episode 4, In the Blood. Two brutal Russian brothers working for Fisk target Daredevil. Elsewhere, Fisk makes a power play to rise in the criminal underworld.
That's right. And this episode came in at an average of 8.42, and that's with six of us giving a score on this one. So this one has, I think, the most scores available, which is pretty good. Yeah. The extended Critical Myth family is definitely enjoying the series big time. Let's see. What did Bronstam have to say about this one? Much needed Fisk focus. Say that a few times fast.
Yes.
Interesting characterization, still a slow build. Yep, mm-hmm. That's about right for this episode. Gary, however, oddly enough, Bronstam gave this one an 8. Gary gave this a 7.5, the lowest I think we've seen out of anyone so far on the show. I continue to be let down by the performance of the Kingpin. While a man of few words, he seems to lack a smug awareness of his power. Interesting.
Hmm.
And maybe a little bit due to the what is demonstrated in this particular episode.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Kingpin does have an unusual introduction here. What do you think, Edmund? You seem to be agreeing with that.
Yeah, I was thinking that it's more the issue of what we're seeing here is very much a Kingpin origin story. So it's yes, he will have that smug awareness of his power, but he hasn't actually gotten the power yet.
Oh yeah, that's a possibility too. My thought was simply that they took a different direction in how they were introducing him to the audience, that they wanted him to maintain a certain level of mysteriousness. That if you went with the traditional way that the Kingpin is portrayed, he's kind of a thug.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're trying to go for a more nuanced look at him, if that makes any sense. Maybe nuanced isn't a word to use, but at least a less physical, a more calculating Kingpin, which seems to be what he's doing here. But I think making the personal introduction via Vanessa was an important kind of change to the way that one would expect the Kingpin to be introduced.
Yeah, because certainly it's introducing that vulnerability right up front, which you don't usually get to see.
Right, exactly. What else would you say about this episode? Because it was so much about the Kingpin.
I thought it still did a good job. I mean, with the stuff with the Russians of still helping to establish that Hell's Kitchen universe and just how nasty and brutish and short for many of the people who try to stay on top. At least if you don't go along with Fisk.
Yeah, and I think that maybe one of the things here, and it's a little bit subtle in a certain sense, is that the fight in this particular episode with Daredevil was oddly staged in that you never saw him really. Mm-hmm. It was all done, you know, like, oh, he's attacking them out of the shadows. And it really felt like, let's find a cheap way to do the fight this time.
Yes.
And I wonder if that took something away from this particular episode as well. But I'm just speculating there because I gave it an 8.5. I thought it was still another really brilliant episode.
Oh yeah, but I did definitely have that sense, and but it was one of those cases of more that whole sequence starting and thinking like, oh, you're doing this on the cheap, and but it was one of those cases of as opposed to, I mean, some of my reactions to some of those earlier episodes of Powers where it just seemed like it was being done on the cheap and it just looked cheap. This is a case of, you know, no, okay, we're saving a little bit of money, but we're trying to still be innovative about it. So.
Yeah. Yeah, they were trying, but the seams did show.
Mm-hmm.
Let's put it that way.
Yep.
All right. In the next one, if you don't mind.
Certainly. This is, believe it or not, Game of Thrones, Season 5, Episode 3, High Sparrow. Cersei meets the High Sparrow after learning of a clergyman's embarrassing tale. Meanwhile, Davos talks to Jon about the future of Winterfell, while Ramsay Snow has just learned the identity of his future bride. Arya grows impatient doing menial tasks in the House of Black and White, and Tyrion searches for more comfortable surroundings on a long trip with Varys.
Mm-hmm.
As one does.
Yes, and this one came in at an average of 8.3. Now, we had a comment from our friend Flacco Jones over at VogNetwork.com.
Yes.
And he said, I feel like things are finally starting to happen now. That might be part of the problem for this season so far. Anyway, it still seems like setup, but I can't imagine we're going to have to wait much longer for actions such as Stannis moving onto the north and Tyrion meeting Daenerys. At least I hope that's the queen Jorah is mentioning. Depends on who he wants to get back in good graces with. That's a fair point. For those who aren't aware of where things are going, I suppose that could have been somehow misconstrued. But, Edmund, let me go ahead and go through the rest of these, and then maybe we pick it down. But first, before I go to what Bronstam and Gary say about this, just in general, do you feel like they're spending so much time on setup that it's almost like you're wondering in the back of your head, how are they going to have time to actually do anything with this?
Yeah, I mean that's been the sort of constant every time they come back, but it does feel like this time, partially because there is so much stuff that happens at the end of that previous season, literally geographically the way things have been spun out, where it does feel like it's taking a little bit longer to sort of get the wheels spinning and get some traction under them this time.
Yeah, it does. Bronstam is basically saying the show is striking its own path relative to the books in the best possible way, streamlining plots and giving characters unexpected room for growth. We'll get into that in a little bit. Gary says, I continue to be... Oh, wait, wrong one. Liked most of the changes, felt like this episode was running forward into the story instead of the typical dragging along. So there seems to be a little bit of a difference of opinion as to whether or not it's finally kicking over or still setting things up. But the general consensus still seems to be it's a slow start.
Yeah.
Now, the big change, I guess, that everybody is referring to, because at least everyone but Flacco, I believe, is up on the current status of the show.
Yeah. Or the books, anyway.
Or rather, the status in the books.
Yes.
At this point of the show. Sorry. The sense that I get here is that everyone's talking about Sansa.
Mm-hmm.
And the big change there. Now, as you know, in the books, the marriage to Ramsay is really Jane Poole, I believe, who is a stand-in
mm-hmm.
for Arya.
For Arya, yes.
Okay. That is clearly not where they're going in the show. Instead, what they're doing is they're taking that whole plot line, and instead of having Sansa kind of doing nothing for a season,
mm-hmm.
like her brother, they're having her take on this role as the Stark that is going to be married off to Ramsay so that there is a basis for Ramsay Bolton to have a claim to the North. This is a big change for Sansa because, of course, on the face of it, it seems like, great, yes, like Bronstone was saying, streamlines things, and I feel the same way. What this means and why people find this so such a substantial change is that you're taking a character that was not a Stark. And therefore, it was just a pretense. But at the end of the day, it was a pretense that once revealed would be that there is no basis for the Bolton claim to the North at all. But you're now replacing that with a storyline where you have an actual Stark
yes.
being married to Ramsay. So while it seems like, oh, it's just streamlining things and that's okay. No, the implication is actually much bigger than one might think. Because at the end of the day, Sansa is a Stark.
Mm-hmm.
It is a big thing. So, I mean, yeah, Edmund, what are your thoughts on this change?
Well, I do like it in terms of this is one of those cases where in terms of just behind the scenes stuff, I mean, I could see where they do want to make sure that Sansa is around to the end of the series, and certainly keeping the actress happy by giving giving her one of the major storylines does make a certain amount of sense in terms of behind the scenes maneuverings. But certainly, I immediately had the same reaction as you in terms of having an actual Stark back at Winterfell does make things very, very, very intriguing in terms of the political dynamics in the North. Especially, you know, as you say, having that sense, whatever maneuverings they're doing on the basis of the fact that it's a Stark at Winterfell, having it happen when it actually is true rather than something that can be wiped away in a moment is quite intriguing.
Yes, and it's kind of the difference between a change like this and what happened with Arya, because Arya's plot thread is essentially the same.
Yeah,
and in fact, I really like the way that they played it out here. But what difference is made is that, okay, in the book, and when we kind of alluded to this before, Jaqen H'ghar is not there.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't really matter because these are the faceless men. For all we know, Jaqen H'ghar is not there right now on the show either.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
So it's like, okay, they could play that a couple different ways if they really, really wanted to. They could, you know, easily hew right back over to where things are in the book without really missing a beat and still getting what they want, which is to have this touchstone for the audience of a familiar face in Arya's plot thread, which is why I feel like they did it this way, which it just makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's just the thing with Sansa kind of much bigger implication, and it really kind of threw everybody that I know who is familiar with the books and the show, it threw them for a loop. And it definitely shows that they're willing to make massive changes. This had to be the storyline that they were talking about, mm-hmm. right?
I would think so, definitely. But I mean, the other thing aside from just sort of shaking out the implications compared to the situation in the books. But what I also loved in terms of the way they built stuff up in the show is this whole idea of the collision now of Ramsay Snow/Bolton and Littlefinger. Much, much subtler conniving of Littlefinger against the more physical tactics, shall we say, of Mr. Bolton.
Mm. Exactly. So, I mean, anyone who's familiar with the books knows that the marriage of Ramsay to Jane Poole did not really go very well.
Mm-hmm.
It's Ramsay after all.
Yes.
And one has to wonder then, how well is this going to work out for Sansa? Are they going to go down the same road? Because if they do, they're going to get into some fairly dicey material very quickly. And so I'm curious if they're going to go that way or not.
Yeah.
We shall see.
Yeah.
I'm not saying anything that anyone shouldn't be able to figure out by the fact that it's Ramsay.
Mm-hmm.
The guy is not stable.
Yes.
What else can we say about this one in particular, Edmund? I'm trying to kind of work it out here in my mind. Go down the list, maybe, of what was in the... Ah, yes, Cersei and the High Sparrow. Foreshadowing much?
Yeah, just a little bit, I think.
The main thing that I don't get here is that I would expect someone like Cersei. Granted, she's not happy about the fact that her teenage son, the luckiest man in Westeros, is cavorting nakedly with Margaery.
Yes.
I get that. She's not happy about this, but really, getting in with organized religion, with fundamentalist organized religion, she's got to know that this is not a good idea, right? Right?
You would think, but no, this is Cersei, so...
Yes, this is someone... scrambling to maintain power at any cost.
Someone who just sees an opportunity to wield power and just takes it without necessarily seeing the bigger picture has been the case.
Yeah, I'd throw a few historical references in there, but I don't want people to react badly. But anyway, yeah. So what we also have here is Tyrion meeting up with somebody on the road. And this is one instance where, again, if they're going down this road, unless they're going to cut out major chunks of this storyline,
mm-hmm.
and I have to believe that they're going to,
we're at
the end of episode 3.
Yeah.
So the season's a third over and they've only gotten this far. I'm kind of concerned that they're either going to really compress things at the end of the season, or we're going to end up feeling like we did after the end of book five, where we go, you got 2/3 of the way there and you stopped.
Yes, exactly.
Boy. Yes,
well, we can just keep hoping for more deviation.
Yes. Although I will say that up at the wall, they are really pacing things out exactly the way that I thought they would. There are literally only a handful of plot points in John's entire journey over books 4 and 5, and every episode so far has had one of those plot points. So they're on the, as far as I can tell, they are exactly on the schedule they should be.
Yes.
So at least they got that one right. But hey, it's not like this is a bad season. I don't want anybody to feel like we're trashing the season. This episode came in at an 8.3, and while it is to be admitted that this season is starting off a bit slow, it's still well within within grasp of getting up to the same kind of scores that the other seasons have had in the past as well. I mean, at the very least, we're looking at maybe a season 2 or 3 versus the heights of season 4.
Right.
But season 4 came out of the gate running. I mean, at this point in season 4, Joffrey was dead. Just saying.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's definitely a slower burn of a season. But I will say this, and I think we mentioned it before. Book 3 was just full of plot. Just tons of things happened in book 3. Books 4 and 5, it takes a long time to get anywhere. So just if they are being even remotely,
especially depending on which version you're reading.
Yes, exactly. If they're doing anything close to adhering to where the books go, then yes, this is going to take a while to get anywhere. But anyhow, let's go ahead then and move on to the next item on the list. And that would be Powers Season 1, Episode 8, Aha, Shake, Heartbreak.
And again, you must just imagine it in your mind, because we have no recap.
There is no recap. Nobody provides a recap. This came in at an average of 8.25. Gary commented saying, although production values are still low, the story continues to go strong. And I agreed, because it came all together in a nice little PR stunt that went horribly, horribly wrong. And they revealed some backstory that I was not anticipating and was actually fairly exciting to learn. So there we are. Let's see here. Next on the list, if you don't mind, Edmund.
Certainly. This is The Good Wife, Season 6, Episode 20, The Deconstruction. And in the latest round of the Henry versus Nadim Wars, we apparently have a truce.
Yes, finally. They seem to be roughly on the same page, because this also came in at an 8.25. Both Henry and Nadim enjoyed this episode. Maybe the rift has been sealed? I'm not sure.
We can only hope.
Yes. All right. Next, we have The Flash, Season 1, Episode 20, The Trap. Barry, Caitlin, Cisco, and Joe set a trap for Wells, but it puts Cisco in grave danger. Meanwhile, Eddie makes a decision regarding Iris, which unsettles Joe. And this came in at an average of 8.2. Despite everybody feeling it was above average, it just wasn't on the same par as the rest of the top 10 shows this week. Bronstam says, retreads ground to bring the characters up to speed with the audience, but in the best, most dramatic way possible. Fair enough.
Yep.
Gary said, great scene with the vault in the computer. I agree. The rest of the episode seemed like a redundant talk about Barry's worries about Wells, regardless of the secret being revealed. So a little bit of a difference of opinion with Bronstam on that, though they still came in at an 8 between the two of them. I just like the fact that we have all these characters that have clearly delineated motivations.
Mm-hmm.
And they're acting accordingly. Yes. I know, this should be standard for fiction. It's not, which is why I'm excited.
Yes,
Edmund, your thoughts on The Flash this week?
Yeah, I was going to say, because if anything, it's kind of amusing that Arrow made the top rankings and The Flash was more in the middle of the pack this week. But as you say, just because it was a good, solid episode. I would say, actually, in what you're just talking about with the characters, if anything, The Flash has done a better job in its inaugural season of actually giving us some characters who aren't just the archetypical lab geek type, cop buddy type. So, yeah, I mean, aside from some of the problems, like Iris still being on the outside, I would agree with everyone's comments in terms of it being that episode where the characters had to finally catch up to where the audience was, which is a bit of an unfortunate side effect of the time slip. But the fact that it's happening now, as we are ramping into the season finale, but bodes well for where it's going to wind up. And John, are you there?
Yes.
Oh, good. Okay. I heard Skype being problematic in the background, but
no, I think it was just a message being sent.
Okay.
But at any rate, we can go ahead then and move on to the next one here, which is Bitten. Season 2, Episode 3, Hell's Teeth. A new threat proves more powerful than anticipated, and the Pack and Coven suffer heavy losses. Indeed, they did. I give this an 8 because it was full of action, and actually, that's the wrong one, wasn't it? Did I look at... No, sorry. I was looking at the wrong thing. That was the recap. The story for this particular show is moving really quickly because they went from 13 episodes to 10 episodes this season, which I think has really helped them keep the focus on the story a lot better. This was full of nice fighting and violence and everything good.
As something called Hell's Teeth should be.
Exactly. All right. Well, what we're going to do here is go ahead and wrap this episode up. And we are going to finish out the rest of the fair for this particular week next time.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as Fair Use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the Critical Myth.